We are live now on the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris. We have a lot to get to today. I want to give you an update, though, before we get into the topics. We're going to talk about the SBC. We're going to talk about Crew. We're going to talk about the VP presidential debate last night. And I did watch it, most of it, probably 90% of it. I missed a little part of the end, but I don't think it was that significant. So I'll give you my general impression and then some of the things being discussed today on X. There's so much. I've saved a lot of things to talk about. And because of the news cycle and how intense it's been and how short it's been, there's a lot of stuff I pushed off and said, I'm not going to talk about it because there's more important things. And so if you have questions, this is what I wanted to say. If you have questions or you want me to talk about something you don't hear me talking about that you think is important during the course of this podcast, let me know. You can do that on YouTube. You can do that on X. You can do that on Facebook in the live chat sections. And I will try to address it because there's a lot of things I've thought through. But like I said, with everything going on and with time constraints, we can only handle so much. And I think that's a scale issue with humans. We operate on a scale that cannot conceive of all the things, especially international news. But let alone national news, let alone the news in our particular Christian groups or social groups or local groups, we have to make decisions as to what we're going to actually talk about. So Ray says, hello from Albuquerque. Hey, Ray. Jimmy Starfish says, John is the apologist we need, not the one we deserve. I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means, Jamie. I hope it's a good thing, but am I an apologist? I don't really think of myself that way. But you know, the thing is, whenever anyone asks me what I do, I always have a hard time. I don't know what to say. I was in Alaska once a few years ago, and someone asked me that on a tour bus. We were in Denali National Park. He said, what do you do for a living? And I said, I talk about religion and politics. And he turned right around and walked the other direction. And I thought, well, maybe that's not the intro I should give. Maybe that's not my opening. But people say, I appreciate your ministry. And I don't correct people when they say that. I know it ministered to them. So what am I going to say? But I don't consider it a ministry, as in I don't look at what we do on this podcast or what I do in my books or even the speaking, whether it's in churches or at political events. I don't view it as ministry in the sense of like official ministry, right? It's not a 501c3, and I'm not the extension of a particular church. But in some ways, I guess I am, right? I am a member of my church. I am accountable to my church. I do talk about a lot of theology. So TrueScript is certainly a ministry, but the Conversations That Matter podcast and the things I do, a lot of it is just things I think are needed, things that often I don't see being said that I think this should be said. And I think I've described it before in the podcast. It really is. It's not a multivitamin, but it is a supplement. And that's what I intend the podcast to be. And that's what it has been. So let me talk about real quick what I was going to talk about, which is the retreat last weekend. Many of you prayed for it. I appreciate that. We had a great time with a great bunch of guys. And this actually was an extension of the Ministry of Grace Bible Church, where I attend, and also TrueScript. And I spoke on Sunday morning. I was also part of a panel Saturday night. I had a few guys, by the way, I wanted to address this real quick. The videos aren't out yet, but they should be coming out, I would think, in the next few weeks. We had a professional actually come and record everything rather than relying on me and whether I forget to take the lens cap off and that kind of thing. And so it should be really good, high quality stuff. TrueScript's going to put it out. But on Saturday night, we had the panel. And I'm one of these guys, I have a hard time hiding my emotions, all right? Like, if I'm disturbed about something, hopefully I'm getting better at this, not in a deceptive way, but just in a, like, sometimes, like, you don't want to eat broccoli at someone's house, right? And then have a look on your face, right? By the way, some broccoli is okay, but sometimes I'm not a big, like, broccoli guy, right? Although I've had some good versions of broccoli, but if it's something I don't like, what's something I really don't like? Spinach. I don't like spinach. I don't know what it is, guys. I know it made Popeye strong. I just don't like it. You don't want to have like a nasty look on your face, right? I'm one of those guys that has a hard time. When I was dating my wife, I remember they had mussels, right? And I'm not a big mussels guy as far as the seafood mussels. and that's all they had. It was like mussels and noodles. And I went over there for dinner, and man, I was trying so hard, but that's just who I am. It's written on my face. And so Saturday night, it doesn't matter. The specifics don't matter, but I had a piece of news that really just bothered me about a ministry that I consider to be mostly a good ministry, positive force for good and that kind of thing. And I got some bad news right before the panel, and I just thought, man, I can't, you know, my mind was somewhere else a little bit. And, and I think some people noticed that. And the next morning, you know, I had a chance to think about it all night. And the next morning is when I gave my talk, and it very much influenced what I said. So I'm excited for that to come out, because I think we all, it's not just me, but I think we all have this tendency, as it's human nature, right, to get discouraged at times. But in the situation we're in now, where you have ministries we thought were solid, showing their true colors, showing that there's compromise, showing that there were attempts in to suppress information that should have been out there, that would have brought accountability, those kinds of things, I expect more and more because of the work that I do. But you know, this, I got a piece of information that just threw me for a loop a little bit. And that happens. That happens to all of us. And I really think, I've been writing on this, I've been thinking about this, that new institutions do need to form, but they can't be the same as the institutions that we had. They can't have the managerial elitism in there. They're going to have elites. Elites are inescapable. You're going to have people who are influential, that people see as an example. We need that. But what I mean by managerial elites and managerial elitism is we don't want people who are loyal to their own managerial class at the expense of those that they should be serving. We need new metrics to determine whether or not someone is actually qualified to be in positions of influence and management. And it can't be simply because you went to a certain school, or you ran in the same crowd, or you have this recommendation from someone who was respected from managerial elite institutions. It's going to have to be something more new. And it's something a lot of us are thinking about and writing about. And it's at a time when the internet and AI is also rising in influence. And so there's many working parts to this, but it's going to have to be based on something older than this weird managerial elite moment we're in. It's going to have to be based on virtue. And that's what I talked about quite a bit. And contrasting neo-evangelicalism and their willingness to syncretize with worldly philosophies in order to gain supposed influence with the actual pursuit of real influence and real power. And that doesn't come with a compromise that syncretizes. You can't do that and gain influence. There's going to be compromises in a political sense, but they can't be compromising ones where you infiltrate yourselves with the thinking of the world. That's not going to happen. That can't happen. And that's what's been happening for years, taking business principles from the secular world that are mostly about manipulation, taking psychology, taking social justice activism ideas, and then just fusing them with Christianity. That's what we've been living in for, I think, a lot longer than most of us know. And that's one of the reasons we did the retreat, and we're doing other events with through TrueScript. We want to raise up men, some men you've never heard of, but you need to, because these men aren't the managerial elites that are riding the conference circuit, that you don't know who they actually are. They're not the Steve Lawson types. They're people who are accountable in their local churches, who aren't going from church to church, messing the churches up. I don't know how many people reached out to me, by the way, after the Steve Lawson thing, and were like, oh yeah, you know, I could see that. Here's a story of him losing his temper. Multiple stories like that. Or here's a story of, you know, have you seen all the churches that he's gone through and how kind of he's just poisoned to a church? He goes into these churches. It doesn't work out. He hops from church to church. He never really wanted a pastor. He just wanted to preach. I'm thinking, man, it'd be really nice if some of that stuff had come out before this scandal. But that's not what we want. We don't want someone who's so distant and so on high and so shielded in the green room, cushioned from everyone, that you only get this image of them when they're on a panel or at the pulpit or in front of a camera. We want people that are accessible, who have accountability in their local lives, who people actually know. They don't disappear after they preach. They're with the people in all kinds of circumstances. Doesn't mean they have the scale to be with everyone who they ministered to on a national or international level. I'm saying in their local churches, their congregations, these are known people. You know who their families are. They don't keep secrets. You know, they're not the kind of people to just have this one side of them. And that's why we do these retreats in part, because we don't have a green room. You're going to be with the speakers. I'm going to try to bring to you speakers. And we had Richard Bargas, who's a great headline speaker, who, he is this kind of guy who is, I think, faithful. And my dad's known him for years, but he's a family man. He doesn't care about money. He's just like all the things that you want. That's the kind of guy he is. And those are the kinds of guys that I try to invite to have come, because they're men of virtue. And that's what we're doing with Truth Script. That's what I'm doing. And that's what we did over the weekend. We had a wonderful time. A lot of guys. We had 70 guys out in the middle of the Adirondack Mountains. Next year, I think we're going to go back to adding another day, only it's going to be a day for fellowship, relaxing, being in the mountains, because there's fishing, there's hiking, there's rock climbing. There's all kinds of things to do up there. And when you only have one afternoon, it feels short. Now, that's what a lot of the guys told me. So we're going to be announcing for next year. We're going to have an extra day, I think. But anyway, I'm feeling good. When I got the news that I got that kind of distracted me on that panel and that evening, I've kind of worked through it. And I'm at the point where I'm like, you know what? The Lord is doing a work. We can trust His sovereignty. He's going to expose what's happening in secret, in ministries that you might have even trusted sometimes, but these ministries had compromise in them. You need to know, I think, when that happens. I don't mean the graphic details of everything. I don't need to know who, you know, exactly what in every way Steve Lawson was doing with this young lady. But to give that one example, but you need to know that when the people that you look up to and trust, if there are major character flaws that people around them notice and don't say anything about, those are the kinds of things that are necessary to, I think, be exposed so that they can be held accountable. They shouldn't be examples to anyone if they're not qualified. If they don't meet the qualifications in Scripture for being an elder, maybe I'm strict, but I say no bueno. You're done, man. That's conference circuit stuff. You know, this elevation beyond the local church. First of all, that's not a great idea anyway, but that's how it's really, I think, spun and presented. Even for people who are all about the local church, they act that way. It's how more so if you're in that level of influence, do you need to have character, virtue? You need to match at the very least those qualifications. All right. So I've spent the first 13 minutes talking, I guess, about myself and the weekend, but hopefully that's a valuable update for some of you. We need to jump into stuff because there's a lot to get into today. And Ray asked, Christian discernment ministry? I guess, yeah, you could say some of what I'm going to talk about politics too today. So we're going to get into some of that. Jenna Cole says, Vance. Yes. Yes, we all, not all of us. Many are saying they like Vance. Okay. Let's talk about crew first, because that might be the longest segment in this whole entire podcast, and that's where I want to get started. So I just want to say Gwen Smith, you're going to see Gwen Smith as the person who is hosting this particular, I don't know what you even call it, meeting. It's a Zoom meeting. It's an all-crew Zoom meeting, and this happened, I think, last Friday. That's why someone else recorded it for me. It's the quality is not the greatest, but you'll be able to hear at least. And Gwen Smith, for those who don't know, is the U.S. National Director of Oneness in Diversity. So it's interesting to me that she, if some of you might remember from Crew 19, it was her and her husband who were on a panel or a teaching seminar and a breakout session. And there was a older lady, I think it was, who said, hey, look, I'm being told I have white privilege. I look through my ancestry. I don't even see any slaveholders in my ancestry. And she's practically crying. What can I do? And, you know, why am I being accused of this? And I remember the Smiths basically said, well, too bad, you got white privilege. That Gwen Smith is hosting this meeting. And I see that as somewhat symbolic or interesting that they're giving her that position in a meeting like this, because I think it sends a message that this is important to GRU, that this isn't going away. The oneness and diversity stuff, the social justice stuff you don't like in GRU, it's not going to go anywhere. Those people are still there, and this is evidence of that. And so they do talk about a number of things. I don't want to get into all of it, but I will show you a few things first. This is not a major thing compared to what we're going to talk about, but there is this section on the diaspora. And I thought it was interesting because it wasn't defined initially, but then it was. And I thought, wow, this is an interesting way to talk about immigrants, migrants, people from other places that are new to the United States. It used to be, just a few years ago, this would be under the banner of diversity. This is diverse ministry, or this is even couched in terms of racial reconciliation, and this is part of, you know, Revelation 7 ministry, where the body of Christ is going to look different, and usually you'd be beaten over the head if you were a white guy for your racism, if you objected, let's say, to ministry funds and being totally rerouted to these endeavors, and people being guilted into having to take this posture of just listening. They can't even engage in a common ground of biblical interpretation because there's these superior perspectives from these diverse people groups. You know everything I'm talking about. This was the DEI CRT stuff. Well, I think that it's like a PR person, like, was determining all the language in this particular, well, really all the presentations. And this one's no exception. So let's talk about this first. This is, I put some timestamps down. We're going to talk a little bit about, I guess, this diaspora.
And what can we change in that? So that's where we're at right now. We're very much in the midst of it, of beginning that phase two. So with that, I'm sure there's a lot of questions in that, but would be happy to answer those that I know now. But I would love to pass it to Angela, because as Gwen mentioned, she's going to give us an update on the diaspora working group.
Thanks, Amanda. I appreciate that. So I'm Angela Kanejan, and I'm Chief of Staff with U.S. Digital Strategies. I live in Orlando, Florida, and I'm going to be giving you an update on the working group's purpose, our members, and a little bit more about the vision and background of the project. So in a few ways, we really served as an extension of the U.S. field team, led by Abraham from GRU City. So with one of the U.S. field team's common strategic priorities being that of reaching the diaspora, we really were asked to build a strategic roadmap that collectively builds movements in the diasporic communities in the United States. So as a group, we've been calling our proposal Win, Build, and Send in, among, and through the diaspora. Our working group members were people from different parts of the ministry that have been serving in or are a part of the diaspora community. And I learned a lot from working alongside those leaders. So we had leaders from City, from Athletes in Action, from Family Life, from Campus, US Capacity, and Jesus Film. So we met as a group of eight, and we really took into consideration not only our audiences, but also our practitioners and the support structures that are out there and that other people have utilized in ministry related to ministry in, among, and through the diaspora. So that's what we've been calling it. Win, build, and send in, among, and through the diaspora. Those are a lot of prepositions. I'll tell you more about it. As I was talking with Angelina from Jesus Film, who also serves on the project, one of the things she observed is we really spent around 50 hours of strategic planning, brainstorming, analysis, and proposal development. And as we did that, we compiled a proposal and made a presentation around a strategic roadmap for ministry through and among diaspora people. So you might be asking yourself, when you think about the vision of diaspora ministry, what is that? So we've been really laser focused on developing a great commission ministry philosophy, framework, and strategy that paves the way for impactful movements in diaspora communities. So that doesn't just mean us showing up and doing all the work. Really, we're acknowledging that diaspora ministry is Great Commission ministry. The Lord has been at work in, among, and through diaspora communities well before Crew started doing any work amongst those communities. So our group spent a lot of time reflecting on Matthew 28:18-20, which we all know. And Jesus came and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you, and behold, I'm with you always to the end of the age." So I read that and spent some time on that passage because we spent a lot of time reflecting on that. This is about making disciples in, among, and through diaspora communities. So it's an invitation of belonging to a community of transformation and growth into the likeness of Christ as we make disciples. And we don't just make disciples amongst ourselves, we cross cultures and we minister to those around us. And God is really a God who is on the move. That was the big thing that we talked about. Dr. Sam George is someone who talks a lot about that, that God has built his kingdom through the dispersion of people. So our group focused a lot on what does it look like to nurture cross-cultural relationships, identifying shared narratives within the diaspora, and mutual resourcing that we can take action hand in hand to holistically help fulfill the Great Commission. Some people warm the seats and hear stories but do nothing about it, but Jesus is on the move. He is still walking on water, calling people out of the desert to be ambassadors of his kingdom. One of the things that compels us in ministry is other people brought the gospel to us. They cross cultures. And really, Jesus is a great culture crosser, and that brought a lot of perspective to our work as we thought about the background of this project. God has always spread his kingdom through people crossing cultures. And so out of that gratitude that we have for others crossing cultures, we want to cross cultures to share the gospel. So what is the diaspora? It's the spread and dispersion of people from their original homeland. The diaspora is made up of both first and second generation people, and it's a part of all of our stories. So I was saying, the gospel came to us through other dispersed people. And as those people cross cultures and others cross cultures to bring the gospel to us, the gospel has reached the ends of earth. And so we want to be people who are recognizing that we're privileged to join in God's building of his kingdom in the ways that he's been at work throughout history. So every hour, over 300 immigrants.
Okay, I'm going to stop right there. There's so many questions. What do I think about this? I don't actually know exactly what I think about it because I don't know exactly what's going on in Crew. It's interesting though. You hear this word, it's a buzzword. You'll hear it like the Lausanne Covenant has a statement about this. There's some other ministries that talk about this, but it's not a word that you hear used a lot. And if this is the way, according to the speaker here, that God is already working, that this is part of a continuation of something he already is doing, then I guess it begs the question, you know, why specifically have a different sector in your organization devoted to it? Like, if this is just the way God moves, then this should just be normal ministry, not a special thing that you have to have a special committee for. But I think it is something special. It is something different. And ignoring the taking out of context theological concepts there, like Jesus crossing cultural boundaries as if he's part of a diaspora coming to earth, that's really strange. Frankly, that's odd. And I wouldn't trust someone to teach the Bible if that's the kind of thing they're teaching. That's clearly not related to what she's talking about, what Angela's talking about here. Jesus left. This was leaving his throne in heaven, leaving his place with the Father, not suspending, obviously, his attributes as the second person of the Trinity. This is why there's a mystery to the hypostatic union, but becoming a man, entering humanity in order to save humanity, specifically entering a Jewish context. Now, that is not the same as people moving from Mexico to the United States. That's not the same as someone coming from Angola to a Western country, right? That is a much more profound theological concept. And to compare them is frankly somewhat insulting, to be honest. It reduces, I think, what Christ actually did. And it's not something we can relate to on the level of immigration. But that's really what is being talked about here, is immigration. And this is a moment in the United States when we have a lot of immigration going on, and some of it is illegal. And so it doesn't surprise me Crewe would be engaged in something like this. And I don't have a problem actually at all. In fact, I think Christian ministry should be spreading the gospel and making disciples of everyone, including those who are coming to Western countries, the United States in particular here, from other places. That may mean that you end up, you know, if that's a priority, you end up hiring people who speak their language and that kind of thing. But I think because of the experience we've had over the last few years, there's going to be a natural skepticism and wondering what exactly is going on here. This is very vague in general, but what are the specific plan proposals for reaching these people, these different people? Is this going to be similar to the DEI stuff that we've seen in Crewe before? Is this going to be where we have to change all our perspectives around and reroute funds going to other ministries to do this thing over here? How successful is it? Is it going to be? Is it going to end up having a political edge that reinforces these people, even if they're illegal, must stay in the United States, just like Sandra Van Opstel talked about in their 2019 Crewe convention? I don't know. I don't know exactly what this is, but I'm just putting it out there that this is a potential place. If I was going to be looking in Crewe to see, hey, where's the social justice stuff still at? Because I know it's still there. Obviously, they've won this in diversity still. And I just talked a few weeks ago about how Family Life had just put out this basically CRT-infused directive. But, you know, if you're still looking for other places, and this is how oftentimes the left acts and operates, they will change terms, they will switch departments, they will eliminate one group and have another group. That's where I would be looking. That's one of the places I would be keeping an eye out to see if that kind of stuff reemerges. That's just wisdom, hopefully, that I'm giving you if you are in Crewe. Just keep your eyes open. Humpty Toast says, is diaspora illegal aliens? That's the question. That's one of the questions I have. I think so. I think they probably would fit into that. They need a translator in order to understand what she is getting at. There are a lot of words, but I don't think she said much with them. Well, that's the whole thing. That's this whole entire thing. And I'm about to show you some other clips that are much more significant that will also give you a lot of words, but I don't know that there's much being said. It's a frustration I have sometimes when I play clips, because I'm like, man, I got to play this whole thing for people to understand what you could have said in maybe a sentence or two. But let's keep going here. I want to share with you, this is the real reason that I wanted to talk about this. I think we're going to go here. Let's see here. Where do I want to start? All right, we'll start here. This is the Theological Development Department talking about the Compassionate and Faithful curriculum, which, as you know, if you listen to this podcast, I did a long podcast on it, is a curriculum that is very influenced by Preston Sprinkle, which is very subversive to Christian teaching on sexuality. And you can go back and watch the podcast I did. Well, here's what they're saying about it. And they give a reaction to some of the critiques that they've received.
Thank you, Gwen. You're kind. I apologize for my voice. I'm a victim of the COVID resurgence day four here, but looking forward to visiting here for a few minutes. One important skill that you and I can develop as missionaries is learning to pay attention to the questions that our audiences that we minister to are asking. I first learned this from missiologist Tim Tennant. And Tennant encourages us as missionaries to listen to the questions both the non-Christians we're reaching out to and Christians that we're ministering to are asking. And he says that as we do this, we'll see recurring questions to which we can relate the good news of the gospel. This is great advice. And it's also one of the factors that led us to develop the compassionate and faithful learning experience. There are a lot of questions today in our culture around sexuality and gender. And as missionaries to families, high school students, college students, military, professionals, athletes, and more, you and I find ourselves on the leading edge of these questions. And over the past couple of years, we've had a chance to journey together through the compassionate and faithful learning experience. And I want to thank you for engaging in this learning experience with us. Based on the feedback you've given us, it's clear that all of us feel better equipped to navigate LGBT plus questions in a way that's compassionate toward people and faithful to the teaching of Scripture. But we've also encountered some challenges in our journey as well.
I want you to notice something here, and I think I was trying to look up, I think this is Keith Johnson, if I'm not mistaken, who you're listening to, who's in the, he's the director of theological development at CREW. Hope I'm not wrong about that. The picture seems to line up, but this is a little fuzzy here. Anyway, this gentleman here, correct me if I'm wrong, if someone's from CREW in there, this gentleman who is in charge of, in some capacity, theological development at CREW, listen to the words he uses here, because I think that there is so much PR and HR talk, really. This idea that it's a learning experience. What do you gain from using a term like that as opposed to a teaching? Well, I think you gain a lot if you're on the on the hook for it. If it's a learning experience, then that means it's not something CREW necessarily endorsed. It's something that is somewhat distant. It is not as proximate to CREW. It's just a learning experience. Let me give you an example. If I said, I'm going to teach on communism for a class on the Cold War, and then someone said, well, I disagree with communism. And I said, well, I'm not teaching it as a way of endorsing communism. I am teaching it as a way of informing you about communism. You can make your own decision as to whether or not you endorse it or deny it, but this is part of a learning experience, right? The teaching is not a teaching of, I'm not giving a stamp of approval, right? It's a teaching where I'm wanting to simply inform you and take you through information that is going to allow you to draw conclusions and come out the other side a more mature person. In fact, that's part of a liberal arts education. You go through a number of texts and volumes. In fact, anyone who does classical education reads a lot of Greco-Roman literature. It doesn't mean you agree with the Greco-Roman pantheon of gods or anything, right? It's a learning experience. So that framing it as a teaching where you have Preston Sprinkle positively giving you really, really bad information about sexuality. Framing it that way as a teaching is much different than saying, well, it is a learning experience that we simply take you through. I think that's what's going on here. It's a very odd term to use.
In response to public criticism, a number of us have received questions from ministry partners about CREW's approach to sexuality and gender. And in our highly polarized context, these conversations can often be challenging. And I want to offer just a little bit of perspective on that. First, I think it's critical for us to have a learning posture towards questions and criticism. James reminds us in chapter 4 that God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. And it's natural to feel discouraged when we get an email asking us questions. I know that I have, but I've also learned to receive those emails and communications as a gift. I'm grateful when a partner cares enough to reach out to me and give me a chance to represent Crew's approach to them. And I often remind myself in these conversations that our partners personally are wrestling with some of these same kinds of questions in their family, maybe in their church and communities. Our team has tried to take a learning posture towards criticism, even when it's not communicated in the most gracious way. And I think one of the things that criticism has done for me is it's really pushed me back into the scriptures to reflect on my understanding of what God has taught us about creation and sin and salvation. And I also try to remind myself that one day we're not going to be standing at the judgment seat before critics, but before our Lord Jesus Christ, and that we want to be faithful to his teaching, both in our manner and in our message.
Okay, a few comments. Treadle says that learning experience also removes connotations of authority that teaching has, very anti-hierarchical. I think that there's a point to be made there. What you hear, and someone confirmed that this is Keith Johnson, what you hear him saying here is essentially we want to have a learning posture, and so we welcome those who have constructive criticism. Now, I happen to know that is not the case in any of the circumstances that I am familiar with, which spans probably at least 15 or 16 Crew staff over the years, as well as those outside of Crew who have tried to keep Crew accountable, even those who have gone way up to the top of at board meetings and have attended board meetings. What he's talking about here could not be further from the truth, from everything that people within Crew have told me. In fact, not long ago, someone from Crew actually reached out to me and told me that, I don't know, I can't give too many specifics because they haven't allowed me to give, but I think I can speak in generalities here and say that they are hurting from criticism, my name being one of the names mentioned, and that anyone who would even associate in any way, which means even having a conversation with me, even having a suspected conversation with me, they don't even have to have the conversation, that gets them in hot water with Crew. And it's a very interesting dynamic because I've watched this over the course of years play out. It doesn't matter if it's lower level, it doesn't matter if it's higher level. Those who criticize Crew's teaching materials, or really anything from Crew that they've put their stamp of approval on, are viewed as enemies immediately. It does not take long. You cannot ask certain questions. I think the most recent public example comes from World Magazine. And I think Elisa Childers had this couple on her show who was, they were staff at Crew. And I have not had them publicly on the show. I have talked to the husband a few times, but I'm trying to remember their names now, actually. I should know this. It should be at the tip of my tongue, actually. And I apologize that I don't. The Mundells, that's right. The Mundells, Uriah and Marissa. And they were brave to go public. That is probably the latest public example. But you can go on my YouTube channel and find a number of other interviews I've done. Most of the people I talk to won't do interviews, but from staff. And they all pretty much say the same thing. They're really not able to get that far when they have concerns and they get the ring around and it's the HR treatment. And so I think that this gentleman is trying to stave off that kind of criticism and that reputation Crew has and saying, no, that's not who we are. We do accept criticism. We do engage these things. And then at the same time, casting some aspersions on those like myself who have had, I think, some valid critiques of some of the things Crew has done by claiming, well, even when they're not nice about it, we want to listen. And we won't be sitting before critics in the judgment. Standing before critics. We will be standing before Christ. Okay, that's true. That's absolutely true. You will be standing before Christ. Critics aren't the ones that ultimately judge your eternal salvation. I have my own critics, by the way, in Crew. They're critical of me. I'm not going to stand before them. But I want you to listen to the way he treats critics and you know, versus the way he treats Crew, right? And obviously this is coming from Crew, but Crew is open. Crew is this great organization that is being attacked sometimes by people who are just unfair. They're not nice. And we're not going to stand before them. If critics have something valid to say, if there's something Crew messed up on, if this really wasn't a learning experience, but it was what it actually was, which was a teaching that Crew was trying to suppress the knowledge of getting out. They didn't want their donors even knowing about this teaching. And, you know, they didn't even want pastors apparently knowing that this is what they were teaching. Where does that place Crew? You know, we're so open to accountability. We're an open book over here. No, you're not. No, that's not how this has been operating since at least 2019, if not before that. So I think there's a lot of deception going on here. I'm just going to call it as I see it.
Our team also tries to have a regular practice of reading people who hold differing views than Crew does to see what we can learn from them. And I think finally, one thing that
I would love to know who those people are. Who are the people that they read that have differing views than Crew, not in a leftward political direction or social direction, and you're not from a theologically questionable direction, but you know, like, for example, are they like, what materials are they using from even a Christian standpoint? Do they use materials that are critical of critical race theory? Which books then? Do they use materials from Bible expositors like John MacArthur? Do they use, in fact, I would expect them to do that, but I don't know if they do. When it comes to cultural things, I mean, are they going to Doug Wilson for that? I'm just really curious, like who do you look to that you disagree with, that you put through learning experiences with? Because this is another way, I think, to cushion it, you can get some pressure off yourself by saying, well, yeah, we paid to produce this material with Preston Sprinkle. And it's a learning experience. And by the way, we have lots of learning experiences where people read things that we don't agree with. It's just to learn, right? Danny Akin tried to do this with Southeastern when he was kind of on the hook we teach liberation theology, but we're not endorsing it, right? We teach all kinds of things we don't agree with. Well, okay, great. So show me, what are the textbooks you use from a very conservative standpoint? Are you got Thomas Sowell stuff? After you read the Kendi stuff, you know, that kind of thing, right? That's what I'm talking about. Like, what? I don't know of any examples.
That I found important to ask myself in this process is, Lord, how do you want to form me spiritually as a follower of Christ through this? And I know that in my life, I've been very aware of the kind of life that I try to find in what other people think of me rather than in Jesus. And I've had to bring that to the Lord. A second, you and I need to cultivate what one leader calls a view from the balcony. Balconies are places that give us a unique vista to see things below us that we might miss. And I've reached out to a number of pastors, Christian leaders, and theologians to try to help better understand some of the cultural dynamics shaping our present moment, particularly in the church. And it's been really helpful. And one person who's helped me get a view from the balcony is the late Tim Keller. I was rereading his book, Center Church. He wrote it over a dozen years ago, and he has a section in this book on cultural engagement. And you can read it here with me. Listen to what Keller says. He's talking about some of the challenges in the church today, and he says the contemporary American church is pulsating with intramural debates, and he gives a long list. He says, when we look on the surface, these look like a diverse array of doctrinal disputes. But more often than not, lurking beneath these issues is the question of how Christians should relate to the culture around us. Some believe that the church's message is becoming incomprehensible to outsiders and we should increasingly adapt it to culture. Others believe the church is already too influenced by culture and we need to be more confrontational toward contemporary societal trends. Most church leaders find themselves somewhere in the middle. They can't agree on where to confront, where to adapt. As a result, the church is fragmenting even beyond its old divisions of denominational and theological traditions. And then this is how he concludes this entire section introducing cultural engagement. In fact, there may be no more divisive issue in the contemporary American church today. And I remember reading that and thinking Keller was prophetic, that what divides us from many of our critics at the end of the day isn't our view of sexuality and gender. It's our vision for cultural engagement.
There it is. There it is. oh, man. So the way this whole thing is couched and framed is that Crew is just this open book. Crew is just waiting for someone to come and share with them criticism so that they can learn from it. And in fact, we accept all these views, or at least we want people to consider all these views that we don't even agree with. And then this is what he does. Hey, look, Tim Keller made this point that what's really fracturing the United States, or the Western world, I suppose, in general, and the church in those regions, what's really fracturing them is not so much theological, but cultural, and strategies for cultural engagement. How do we go about engaging with this culture, reaching this culture, doing this really upstanding thing, right? And so he then wipes away all the criticisms in one fell swoop. All these criticisms that he wanted to take so seriously, to learn from, now he just wipes them all away in one fell swoop and says, you know what? This is really over. This is over something not that important, really something superficial. It's not like it's a theological problem we have, which is the accusation. That's the criticism, that you have a theological problem, especially with the example here, which is the compassion and faithful teaching. It's not that. It's not where. So he's already basically saying, we're not going to take seriously criticism that says we have a theological problem with compassion and faithful, because that's not what we have. It's a disagreement over cultural engagement. Well, doesn't that sound a lot better? You see red and I see yellow. You want to go out there and preach the gospel, and you want to hand out tracts, and I want to go out there and preach the gospel, and I want to street preach. And someone else might want to do a personal relationship evangelistic endeavor. And these are all different ways, but you know what? At the end of the day, aren't we all trying to engage the culture? Not a big deal. Not a great thing. It's just, that's what's going on here. It's the minimization of the critiques. That's what he's trying to do. He's casting aspersions on the critics. He's minimizing their critiques by putting them in a different category, all the while trying to give you language that makes you think, oh, they're so open. They're so willing to engage. If you have a question, you can really go to them. But those in Crew who have had questions, you tell me whether that's true. I've never had anyone tell me from Crew that they got a response when they tried to share a concern that was anything but suppressing. All right, we got to keep going here. So let's do it.
And I think when we're at our best in Crew, we have what I might call a Jesus-first approach to culture. Our lead foot is, can I tell you about Jesus?
Oh my goodness. How do you even argue with this, right? Now the critics are arguing against a Jesus-first approach to culture. Man, that really puts us in a bad light, right? So if you have problems with Crew, you have a problem with their cultural engagement, and their cultural engagement is Jesus first. So you must have a problem with a Jesus first cultural engagement. He's giving an argument for not listening to critics. Meanwhile, saying we listen to critics.
Can I tell you about how beautiful Jesus is? Why? Because we believe the gospel is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes. Third and final perspective I want to share is that going forward, we think it's increasingly important for us to speak in our own theological voice. We're profoundly grateful for those outside Crew who have helped us, but it's critical for us going forward to speak from the scriptures in our own voice. This doesn't mean we'll never use external communicators, but it does mean that we want our organizational voice to be clear. Well, with that perspective in mind, I want to talk a little bit about the next chapter of our LGBT plus equipping. We created the current Compassion and Faithful Learning Experience to provide a way at the same time for staff in every division to have the chance to grow and learn. Now that we've moved through that process, we're actually focused on a relatively small audience of new employees, particularly new staff, interns, and part-time field staff. And that gives us a lot of options that we didn't have available when we were looking for a scalable solution for the whole organization. And so our plan going forward is to integrate our LGBT plus equipping into existing developmental venues like the Institute of Biblical Studies. So I'll give you just one example. Our plan for new staff is that we would help them grow in navigating LGBT plus questions in the context of the Intro to Christian Theology class. All of them take this course as a part of their onboarding. And I'm excited about that. There are several advantages to this approach. First, this gives us the chance to talk about sexuality and gender in the context of all the other major doctrines we share as followers of Jesus, our understanding of God's good work of creation, the devastating effects of the fall, the redemptive work of Christ, the application of Christ's work by the Spirit, sanctification, the church. Second, this also allows us to speak in our own theological voice, not depending on outside presenters. Third, it gives us an opportunity to have a conversation about sexuality and gender face to face. And finally, we think this is going to provide a scalable, sustainable, ongoing way to help equip our staff. So access to the current Compassionate and Faithful Learning Experience will end on December 31st. And we're already in the process of moving forward on the new plan that I described to you with our newest groups of new staff and interns. Alongside of this, we'll continue to think about how we can resource all of us.
All right, we're going to end there. So if this teaching is so bad, why not just send it now? But they're not. They're going to continue for the next few months. It's going to end at the end of the year. Okay, whatever. Instead, they're going to take the teaching, the LGBTQ plus whatever teaching, and put it in their introductory theology class, which means that this isn't just a special thing they're going to put all of the crew staff through. This is actually, I don't even know if Compassionate and Faithful was all crew staff. This is for all crew staff, though, now. And I think if you read between the lines, you don't even have to do it between the lines. What he's saying is, we're going to not have Preston Sprinkle involved in the curriculum development. We're going to do our own in-house curriculum development. And this is a way of, I think what's going on here is there's been a lot of criticism. Crew's lost a lot of money. They've lost a lot of donors. And one of the criticisms lately has been you're partnering with this Preston Sprinkle guy. And so this is a way to distance themselves and say, no, we're not going to be with him. But I'd be curious, and I'm sure many of you will, to see, okay, what are they going to put in their intro to theology then? They're not admitting any wrongdoing. They're still using the curriculum. But for crew staff who are entering crew, what's that going to look like? You're going to have to see, I guess, because I don't know. Is it going to be the same kind of teaching that's now everyone has to take? And it's more hidden because it doesn't have that label on it? Or is it going to be different and they're just never going to admit that they really messed up theologically on this? I think this was a pathetic and insincere, I guess. It comes across as insincere, but it's a pathetic and weak attempt to deal with this problem. They should just be honest. We're getting rid of it. We got a lot of pressure. It's theologically bad, and we're sorry. We apologize to crew, but nope, that's not going to happen. It's our critics are disagreeing with our Jesus first cultural engagement principle. Oh my, oh my, oh my! All right, one last thing. Let's go to the end here. Mark Gothier, who's the president of Crew, talks about some things. He talks about criticism. There's two clips I've wanted to play from him.
Has long taken a posture of not responding to criticism and critiques from outside the organization, impacting our organizational fund development efforts and our staff's personal MPD efforts. In the current soup that we swim in, and where critiques fly fast and furious, are we holding fast to that posture? And if so, is there any evidence to suggest that this is the correct approach? Or to the contrary, is there any evidence that suggests we should be more proactive and offensive in our responses to outside criticisms in the current digital culture? Another question was, I'm aware of some staff losing support. This is related to this as well. As a result of the video done of the staff person who did an interview with World Magazine. While I'm grateful for the training and biblical position documents that have been created, it feels like staff are left to themselves to defend Crew's position, often encountering a lack of willingness from the supporting church to dialogue or to respond in any way, except with silence. Can you explain senior leadership's next steps in addressing this challenge? Well, I don't think I'm going to be able to fully explain it now, but I think there will be a time to come where we will get into this a little bit more. But I do want to say a few things. And really what Keith shared, first of all, was super helpful. And you'll see some of what I'm going to mention show up in the way he talked about how we've engaged externally with people in the midst of the critique and the criticism that we have received. And the second thing I want to say is it grieves my heart and all of us as leaders to know how this impacts so many, whether it's losing support or the hurt that you experience or just the frustration and the work that it has created for many of you in terms of conversations, et cetera. So I just want to acknowledge that. I know that's really, really hard. And it's very challenging at times to engage on these topics and even to know what can I say, what can't I say. So this isn't the end of this conversation at all, but I just want to make a few comments about this. First of all, our longstanding approach and posture has been to not respond to external criticism and critique publicly. And the reason in part for that is because our ministry, we go to where people are, regardless of lifestyle, regardless of views. We're missionaries. So we go to share Christ and connect with everybody. We found that trying to have dialogue publicly really loses the nuance and the sensitivity that we feel is very important to what God has asked us to do. I will say there is a significant team of people gifted in communication and our theological development team that we're regularly evaluating. Is there another approach that we need to have in this context? So, while we've had this historical practice, it doesn't mean that we're not thinking about what is the best way to both communicate our posture and our position. And that's really what Keith was getting at when he said, you know, a lot of times what we're finding, and in this particular topic, is really it isn't so much about the theology. It's not about the position. But it's really around top issues related to posture. And that's not to say that other people are wrong and bad and don't have a good posture. It's just to say that we hold dearly in our hearts and our practice the calling to communicate the gospel to everybody. And that puts us in a situation over the years where we do open up to criticism and critique. And what we've gone through has been, it's been significant over the last few years, but it's not unusual. Historically, there have been many times where because of what we're doing to engage with people, there has been significant feedback. Now, we think it's super important that we do engage the feedback. And Keith made some important points by saying, number one, we always want to be people with a posture of humility, and we want to learn. Our ministry is relational. We are incarnational in what we do. And what that means and what we found is that the most effective way to engage our critics has been primarily in the context of relationship, personal conversations. And so we've worked really hard to actually be open and available and initiative, have a position of initiation to be able to discuss with people their concerns and their critique, which is very, very important. And we learn from that, and we need to learn from that. At the same time, our general approach to this has been, it's been very favorable. By and large, it helps people to understand what we are trying to do and understand our position, but also appreciate our posture. Now, I'm not going to say that this always works out for us, but a lot of times it does. The second thing I want to say about this is we believe in that spirit that we, all of us, are the best asset we have for communication and connection. And I know there's a tension here because we recognize we may not be adequately resourcing you to have those conversations with the people with whom you're relating with that have concerns or critique. And our strategy has been to provide for you what you need so that you can engage appropriately with people. So I want to say two things in closing on this. Number one, if you need help in responding to questions or concerns about crew, please reach out to your supervisor and they can connect you with people in your specific ministry who can best come alongside of you. And we always want to do that. We've also worked with all of our ministry's leadership and our MPD team to help make sure we've got resources to help you field questions. And obviously they're available, we're available to partner with you in that. Second, we are continuing to evaluate if, one, we need more resourcing and support for all of us. And when at our next update, may have the opportunity to share a little bit more about how this is working out for us and what we're seeing in terms of moving forward. But I know there's a lot we could say about that. I just want to say thanks for the questions. Thanks for your engagement. And we're confident the Lord is in this. He's given us an incredible mission. Keith said, we're a Jesus first ministry.
Okay, I think that's the relevant part. There's a lot of words there and not much help if you're in crew, unfortunately. You're not going to be able to HR or PR yourself out of this. This is basic stuff. When it comes to compassionate and faithful teaching, it really comes down to, do you believe what the Bible teaches about human sexuality and gender? And if you don't believe that, or you're subverting it in your teaching, then you can't just PR your way out of it by putting a good face on it and saying crew is great and rah, rah, rah. You can't cushion it or use a mechanism like we're going to just have relationships and conversations and that's going to solve this. These aren't tools that actually address the root issue. And I don't think they're using those tools. I don't know. The people I know in crew who have voiced concerns about these things, they end up getting shunned. They're not the kind of people that just have crew tripping all over itself to reach out to them in these relational ways. Oftentimes when I hear this, I think wine and dine, right? Like I remember Danny Aiken, I think did this somewhat. And I know he does this to other people. I know this about Southeastern. I can share this. When he gets criticism, that is one of his go-tos. It's like, come on down to Southeastern. We'll put you up and we'll treat you well, right? And I'm not actually saying that's a very, like a bad strategy. If someone's, I don't think the critiques are misunderstandings, but let's say someone is misunderstanding you. You can say, hey, come on, get to know us better. But the thing is, you can also put on a show. It's easy to do that. In fact, believe it or not. Okay, so this is, I am not comparing Danny Aiken or crew or any other Christian ministry to the person that I'm about to talk about in the sense of saying that they have, their morality is the same, or they're not the same in the same category at all on that. When it comes to strategy, though, I just had this thought. There was a friend of mine years ago. He wanted to go to North Korea, and I'm like, North Korea, really? Like that? But he showed me this whole like vacation package thing they have, and they pull out the red carpet, and they love to apparently show Americans this side of North Korea that you're not going to see, right? And communist countries, I know, have done this for a long time. This was who was the reporter who went to Soviet Russia in the 1930s and said, "I've seen the future. I know it works." And it's because Stalin wasn't showing him all the starving people. He's only showing him what he wants the person to see, right? It's easy to manipulate, actually, in those kinds of situations if you control the schedule and the itinerary. Anyway, I haven't seen crew do that kind of thing. I've never seen them reach out to anyone I know who's been critical of them, even within the organization. So it's denial, it's disguising things. That's how they tend to operate. And so it's just odd that Mark Gothier is like saying, well, this is who we are as crew, right? And acting like this is a normal thing. We've always gotten controversies about our approach, and that inspires feedback. Well, yeah, but feedback over you're denying some very basic teachings in scripture that are fundamental. I don't think maybe strategies, maybe there are things that crew's done that I don't know what the example of that would be. I'm trying to even think. There's been critiques about the way they do evangelism, like it's too formulaic and it skips over the law, the use of the law. I've heard things like that, but nothing like this, where it's like, no, you're training your staff members to subvert the biblical teaching on gender and sexuality. Nothing that basic, nothing that intense. And quite frankly, I have my doubts. I don't have charts in front of me, but I would be very curious to see what's happened since 2019 with their giving. I think it's gone way down. That's my guess, that they've taken a big hit. They're continuing to take in water, or they wouldn't be talking about this if they weren't. So, what are they going to, what are they going to do? How are they going to navigate this? We're still talking about it. Well, it's been, even if you want to gauge it since Rosaria Butterfield made her statement against crew, what was that, last fall? It's been about a year almost, if not about a year. Yeah, I think. And you still don't have a way forward on this. You're still in conversations about how we're, if you're a crew staff member, I don't think help is coming, guys. Like, you're stuck. You have someone who can relate to you in all the maternal ways, but you don't have someone who's actually willing to take ownership of what they've done and chart a concrete path forward. Masculinity seems to be gone from crew. And I'm sorry for those who are good staff members still in crew doing good work, because you don't deserve this. Lots of comments coming in. Keep bringing them, by the way. If you have questions, especially, I'll look for those. But if you've been a supporter of this podcast, if you're a patron, if you go to patreon.com/worldviewconversation, if you're one of the people who supports what I do in prayer or otherwise, yes, some of what's happening here and what's coming to a head is the result of folks like myself and others. I think I was actually one of the first. I don't want to say I'm the first, because I don't know. There may have been someone at a lower, in crew. I think there were discussions happening. But in 2019, I think I was one of the first guys to start exposing what was happening in crew. And all it took was I just started watching their videos from their 2019 crew convention, and I was shocked. And since then, it's just been one fire after another, and the crew organization does not respond well to even constructive, friendly criticism. The people who put together the concerned document, I can't remember what they called it, theological concern document, where it was very extensive and they did a good job on it. A lot of those guys were let go from crew. They're not going to get promotions. They don't respond well to it. And they're trying to put the word out there that they do. And it's just, I think, disingenuous. I really don't care for crew, I'll be honest. I've watched them over the course of years, hoping they would course correct and stuff. And seeing the way that their leadership reacts, I just have like next to no respect. And it's a shame because they've done good in the past and there's still some people doing good work with them in various capacities. But I couldn't in good conscience partner with them. I'll be honest. I couldn't work for them. I couldn't partner for them. Not when there's other options out there. All right. Someone asked, oh, what is this? Okay. Is there anything in scripture that ever indicates that posture outweighs position? I think it says the opposite thoughts. Yeah. Cause you heard Mark Gothier saying, you know, separating posture and position. Yeah. Posture is, I think of posture as the, it's kind of like tone, right? It's the, like if you have an aggressive tone with someone that communicates a lot, even if you're saying nice things. And a posture I see is similar to that. If you have a defensive posture, you can tell. So walking into a situation with a posture is also communicating. The posture is part of the message. Okay. So I think of like speak the truth in love. Like you should have a certain disposition. If you're going to, you can say the same thing to someone who's unruly or is faint-hearted or is weak, but you're going to possibly take a different posture, which means a different message too. You could be saying the same theological truth, but the message changes in the sense that you're going to be nouthetic towards the person who is unruly. You're going to correct them in a way that's more aggressive. So it's a different posture than someone who is weak and needs help. So you could say, knock it off. You got to stop lying, right? But if there's someone who's humble and says, I'm weak and I need help, you might approach them with a different posture than you do someone who is unruly and is just lies and loves to lie and is going to continue lying. You're saying the same thing. You need to stop lying, but you might add some things. You might approach it differently. You might use a different tone. I see that all as part of the message as well. So I don't know exactly what Mark Gothier means by that, but and doing a search for posture, the original Greek, not finding it yet. Yeah, I don't think the words in scripture, this is an English term that we are then imposing on scriptures. Not probably the best word to use in that situation. I use it when it comes to politics. Sometimes I'll say conservatives take a posture of trying to conserve true and valuable things, right? That's our disposition. That's our default setting. We walk into situations with that intent generally, but yeah, when it comes to the Bible, I see the concept, I think, but I don't see the word. All right. I haven't talked about the SBC. I'm about to get there. I don't have much to say about the SBC. We've been going an hour and 12 minutes. This is going to be a longer podcast. So let's just do that now. Let's talk about the SBC, shall we? So there is an article that came out on September 20th. So now we're going back a little ways. It wasn't that long ago, but it feels like ancient history now. Let me see if I can pull it up for you. And I just think the Center for Baptist Leadership has a lot of good information on this stuff, but it's by John Whitehead. And the title is Liquidating the Assets of Our SBC Fathers to Finance the Power Plays of the Sons. And let me just bring you through some of the information that you will find if you want to read this article. Basically, he talks about the creation of a new abuse department in the SBC. So the executive committee met and they've established a new department focused on responding to sexual abuse within the SBC following a directive from the 2024 annual meeting. Now, this move marks a shift away from the initial proposal of forming an independent nonprofit called the Abuse Response Commission, ARC, which faced criticism from potential conflicts of interest and increased legal risks. So this is good in one sense. If you're rooting for the SBC to remain faithful, it's good in the sense that they didn't go with the ARC, which would have been independent, but they are still going to have their own separate, not separate in the sense that it's separate from the SBC, it's still part of the SBC, but they are going to have their own department, if you will, focused on sexual abuse reform. So what does that look like? I don't know, but generally, you know, the suspicion is that this is not going to be a good thing for the SBC. Over $12 million has been spent on legal fees already related to sexual abuse claims. This includes significant payments to Guidepost Solutions, the consulting firm which conducted the investigation into the SBC's handling of abuse allegations. Despite these expenditures, no settlement with victims were mentioned, only legal defense costs. So, people like Johnny Hunt or David Sills, they're not talking about settling with them. They're going to keep the exorbitant legal defense costs going. As a result of these exorbitant legal defense costs, the executive committee has authorized the sale of SBC's office building in Nashville. This decision is linked to the need to cover operational and legal expenses. This is something like, what, $38 million? I don't remember. It's like an over $30 million building. And you can't get that back. And it's sad to see over the course of just a few years what's happened in the SBC. They have just run their organization into an iceberg. And I didn't even know this article talks about how they sold their property, which was overlooking the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, for Golden Gate Seminary, and now have this, I guess, this office building near an airport. And, you know, sometimes you need to do things like that, but it's just, this is it, really what it does is it sends the signal that we are in the decline. We are going down. The ship's going down fast. If something's not done quick, they're going to be in real trouble. And of course, this might be one of the worst parts of the whole thing. The executive committee declined to implement full financial transparency by not moving forward with 990 level reporting, which would require SBC entities to disclose comprehensive financial information, including legal expenditures. That's terrible. They can't keep themselves accountable. And it's stuff like that that makes you think, well, they just don't deserve, I guess, to keep going. They don't deserve it. I don't know what to say. It's just sad. So that's the SBC. I would say, yeah, I mean, I know guys like William Wolf and guys at Center for Baptist Leadership, I think are going to want to see some positive developments. And they're going to look at some of this and say, well, it's not as bad as it could have been, which is, I think that's really the positive takeaway, is it could have been worse, but it's still going in the bad direction. And I think that it just seems to continue that every year. So I don't see much changing on the SBC front, except for what was warned about a few years ago by not only myself, many others warned about this. We, even within the organization, is just coming to fruition. And I hate to be right about it, but here we are. All right. Well, let's talk about the vice presidential debate some. I will get to your questions as much as I can at the end. I don't have any clips to play for you. We've been going long enough as it is, but I do have some thoughts to share with you. I did watch most of it, and I thought J.D. Vance did a great job as far as a debate is concerned. And I don't actually consider these debates in the traditional sense. I've done a few formal debates. I did one on capital punishment when I was in a debate club, and it was like a homeschool debate club when I was in high school. But we had a coach from a local university, and had a great time doing that. I was in favor of capital punishment. That's what I had to argue for. And then since then, I've done a few formal debates. I did one, I did two at SUNY New Paltz, where I debated first an atheist who I'm actually still friends with. And he's a pro-Trump guy, as far as I know right now. It's an interesting dynamic. And then I debated a young student or a female student on the question of abortion. And in a formal debate, you generally have opening statements, you have rebuttals, you have cross-examination, and then you have closing statements. And they're all timed. Sometimes you will have questions from the audience, but there's a timekeeper. And that's what a debate is. You have a timekeeper, essentially. These are not debates, really, in that sense. They are, it's a time for the media to scrutinize the candidates. And the media is slanted very much towards the Democrats. This was no exception, especially the way this debate started off. The questions were so slanted in a leftward framing toward, really, I think, in favor of Tim Walz and against J.D. Vance. J.D. Vance handled them masterfully, though. At one point, one of the moderators tries to fact check J.D. Vance about the migrants in Springfield, Ohio, not being illegal. And J.D. Vance basically fact checks her right back. They turn off his microphone. It was interesting to see how he handled the moderators. I don't know that he could have done a lot better, except on one question. He's very well-spoken. He keeps bringing things back to the failures of Kamala Harris. Just really good. Tim Walz was a mess. Tim Walz, there's the one clip that I'm sure is going to be going viral where Tim Walz is asked an actually hard question. That's like one of the hard questions he was actually asked from the moderators. about why he lied about his being in China during what do they call it now? The why am I blanking on this? I can't remember. I'm forgetting the name of the event that Tim Walz said he was in China for. Someone help me in the chat here. so I remember. It's on the tip of my tongue here. Tiananmen Square. That's it. Why did I forget? How could I forget that? By the way, the Tiananmen Square photo of that one guy who was resisting the tank, we don't know where he went and stuff. That is the most shared image in all of world history, supposedly. Anyway, Tiananmen Square. Tim Walz said he was there. They said, you know, why'd you say that when basically we fact checked you? You're not, you weren't there. And Tim Walz had a horrible response. It like, he just basically admitted, yeah, I lied. That was basically it. But he did such a roundabout way of like, I grew up in the middle class and I'm trusted by the people who love me and this and that. And I just get carried away and I'm a buffoon sometimes. And so anyway, it was really bad. But JD Vance was confident, mature, I think, respectful, clear, on message. The one time I thought, man, he could have done a lot better here is the abortion questions. He eventually took the high ground by calling out what the Democrats, their position as radical. He eventually did that. It took him a while to get there. And he really wanted to focus on federalism, that the Trump administration is going to allow the states to decide what their abortion policy is going to be. And if, I mean, that's who he's running with. That's that. I mean, he even said himself, he was surprised that Ohio voted against his own perspective on this issue, which I thought was good that he said that, because at least he's admitting, look, this is, I have a perspective on this, which is more pro-life, yet I have political constraints that even affect me in my own home state, that don't allow me to push the policies that I want in the most aggressive ways. I have to take a defensive posture on how far we've already pushed the needle as pro-life, anti-abortion people. And I have to make sure that we solidify those gains. That's basically what I heard him say. We're going to solidify the gains made by the Trump administration on Roe v. Wade, overturning it with the Dobbs decision. And we're not going to go past that. Politically, probably a wise move, I would guess. But morally speaking, I think that he could have done a lot better job trying to take the high ground and still admitting, like Tim Walz is bringing up all these victims, women's names who have been victims of this or that, you know, 12-year-old who was raped and now she's got to carry this baby. And he could have made the point that the reason you do not hear the names of the millions of children who die as a result of abortion is because they never have a chance to actually get a name. They are never named. And while Tim Walz pulls up these few examples, there are millions of children who are dead because of murder. As soon as you shy away from this being that issue, and it then I think that you lose the moral high ground. Even if it's an unpopular position to take, you have to keep the moral high ground on a political level, I think. These are just John Harris's unadulterated thoughts on this particular subject. I do think you do have political reality. And so this is one of the things I wanted to talk about with the political reality thing, because I've seen some people online not like it when I say that, especially people who really want a hardcore anti-abortion agenda, which I also want. So here's what I have to say about that. J.D. Vance is, I would say, a mixture of a lion and a fox. If you look at many political theorists use these two animals as analogies. I think it started with Machiavelli, though. He talks about foxes and lions. And the Democrats typically put up foxes. In fact, I can't really think of a Democrat candidate who wasn't a fox. If they would have nominated someone like Kennedy, they would have had a lion on their hands. But they don't tend to nominate lions. They nominate foxes. Foxes are sly. They see traps coming. They set traps for others. They're cunning. They know how to gain power and hold on to power. They don't necessarily have virtue. Lions tend to be more virtuous. if they're not virtuous, at least they tend to be very open and honest and out there. And the way they govern is not through manipulation like a fox, but through force. So they threaten and they use force to drive their agenda. Trump is a lion, basically. Lions also have a hard time, though. Their weakness is they have a hard time seeing traps laid for them by foxes, which is also Trump. I think it was wise to have J.D. Vance on the ticket because J.D. Vance has a unique ability to be both a lion and a fox. And Machiavelli said that was the combination that, you know, is useful basically for politics. J.D. Vance comes across as confident that he's going to hold on to policies that he believes in. But at the same time, he understands the political reality that he has to deal with. And as a result of that, he knows where the lines are. He knows what not to talk about, what questions not to answer directly, and where to really hammer the other side. Democrats get into positions of leadership, and what they do once they have them is they end up driving their own agenda. So they will even engage in lying, right? They'll tell you what you want to hear. Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are doing this right now on things like fracking and gun rights. They want to run to the right a bit. They want to be perceived as moderates. Kamala Harris has all these great ideas, which for some reason she can't implement now. This is all part of trying to outfox the American people by presenting themselves as moderate. If they can just gain power, then all that moderation is going to go out the window and they will push their radical agenda. That's what we've seen. That is the pattern. Republicans don't tend to be that way. They tend to be lions, and they tend to, they say that they're going, these are their policy positions. They oftentimes are unrealistic. They get into office and they have to go through negotiation procedures, and they don't ever, they hardly ever are able to accomplish what they set out to do. They're foiled by the foxes. So the first thing for Democrats is power. That's the fox's first aim, is power, power, power. If you don't have power, you can't do anything else. Your agenda is meaningless. All the high and noble goals you have for doing good public policy, all of it meaningless unless you have one thing: you need power. So let's try everything we can to get that power. Once we have power, then we worry about that. That's the Democrats. That's their approach, and it's worked for years. And the Republicans tend to be more principled, and this is what I'm going to do, and if it hurts me or not, I'm going to hold on to this. And we respect that. We admire it, but it gets you to the some oftentimes to the beautiful loser category. I think J.D. Vance, and he did admit this, I think he is much more pro-life. He said it as much. You know, the voters of Ohio disagree with me. He is a fox, though, too. He's got that side of him where the most important thing right now is gain power. If you don't have power, you can't do anything on the pro-life front. So what do I expect? I expect if Trump and Vance get into office that they are going to be pushing the needle in a more pro-life direction. I do think that. I don't expect you to have to think that or believe that. I expect, though, I think that Vance is a fox on this, and that it's not just with that issue, with other issues too. I think, for example, they asked him, you know, how are you going to deport all these, you know, the people that are here illegally? And he gave kind of a roundabout answer. Well, we're going to start with criminals, and then we're going to change the incentives so that migrants aren't undercutting the American people. Trump's talked about the greatest deportation in history and all of this. Vance is a fox. Trump is more lion. Trump is going to talk that way because that's the goal he's shooting for. That's what he's going to do. And he's also a business guy. So you create goals that just seem that move the needle in your direction. You try to shift the Overton window. And then when someone comes to the negotiating table, you moderate. That's how Trump has always operated. And sometimes a fox can use that strategy, but I think in Trump's arsenal, that's like his one trick. That's what he always does. Vance, I think, is more cunning in a good way. Like, he's more prudent. We'll put it that way. He's more prudent. And I think on an issue like that, he's not going to come out and say something like that that will probably cost them some votes. But he will try to address the problems that people can relate to in their own life. And look, he's dealing with a population that is... much of the population is very ignorant. much of the population also is evil and selfish. And you unfortunately, in a democratic system, you have to appeal to that to in order to get elected, in order to get power. You have to somehow convince enough of those people to vote for you. This is why democracy, some people have a lot of reservations about it, and people are questioning it more and more. If you have a public that is not virtuous, how do you get virtuous leaders? How do you get if the whole thing eventually breaks down, you have to have a virtuous public for democracy to work. And we don't have that. So I think under the circumstances, everything that Vance is dealing with, I say he did a good job. And I'm not going to kick the guy when he's down. I voiced my disagreement with not taking the moral high ground sooner on the abortion question, because if this is murder, we should treat it like that. But I think overall, Vance did a pretty good job given the circumstances that he's in. So I'll take any comments on this, and we'll go from there. All right. Yes. Thank you, Dr. Bob. Tiananmen Square. Sometimes maybe I'm getting older. Maybe I'm having Biden moments. Wouldn't that be bad? I need to get more of the Chuck Norris's drink mix, because it seems to help with the memory, you know. But Tiananmen Square, man, that's one of the most pivotal in Chinese history. That is, I know someone actually from China. I was talking to them about this, and it's just one of those things that stands out in their history, like that one time where there were cameras, and you know, people kind of whisper about it, but it's like erased from the official histories and stuff. They don't even talk about it, but it's was such a big event. People still know about it. Let's see. Someone says an Act Blue ad came up asking for Kamala donations on this YouTube channel. That's great, because they're just wasting their ad money. No one's gonna donate who's a listener of this show. Vance's closing statement was exceptional, that he actually said, whether you vote for me or Tim, I want you to succeed, or something to that effect, is a 100% class act move. I loved it. I loved it. That was really good. Trump did that as well. To be fair, he said he was going to lock her up. Oh, I think we're talking about Hillary. He said Mexico was going to pay for the wall and it would be huge. That didn't happen either. Yeah, there were things in the Trump administration that didn't happen. I was surprised he was able to get as much done as he did get done. I think JD will help President Trump surround himself with better people. Yes, 100%. JD has more horsepower than walls. Yes, I believe so. I'm disappointed your mustache has disappeared. My wife isn't. That's why it's disappeared. My wife is not disappointed by that. I had one day and one afternoon where I had the handlebar. That's why you have to come to the men's retreat. That's the only time you're going to see it. It's sleep. When your baby is sleeping through the night consistently, your memory will improve. You know what? She's actually doing pretty good. I don't know if I can use that as an excuse, but you are right. I'm actually still catching up on sleep from the weekend. You just can't on a men's retreat. You know, you get a couple nights where it's like 3 hours a night or something. It's just, you're staying up late. You're getting up early. It's just how it is. Just how it is. Did you hear J.D. Hall has been vindicated from false charges? I did. There's an article at Protestia. I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing, but I talked to David Morrill about this a few days ago, actually. And I'm really glad that Protestia, you know, an organization that is, unlike Crew, able to admit when they're wrong about something, which I really appreciate. Why are so many Christians refusing to vote for any candidate? Harry Cromer asks. Because pro-life or pro-choice? Because both are pro-choice, yet there are demonstrable differences between the candidates. Is it a sin to not vote? James 4:7. Is it a sin to not vote? It could be. It could be. I hesitate to say yes, 100%. I mean, I can think of scenarios where it's impossible, right? You would have every intention of voting and you got sick that day, or you couldn't, you know, I don't know. A blizzard came. What happened in North Carolina happened. I don't know what's going to happen in Western North Carolina. Are they even going to be able to vote? Is this going to throw the state to the Democrats, or is this going to be good for Trump? I don't really know. But so when you have the opportunity to vote, to, you know, when, even evil fathers give their children fish, unbelievers take care of their kids. You're worse than one if you don't. I think that this is part of that whole mechanism. God's given you an ability to provide, or at least to protect your children. So yes, I think this is part of your civic responsibility if you have the opportunity to do it. Absolutely. You know, as far as they're both pro-choice, I've talked about this before. I don't want to beat a dead horse on the podcast, but there are two things I think to remember. The first is, yes, there's a lot of other issues. This isn't the only one. There's issues that will directly affect your children who are born in this world, and you need to think of those issues as well. The second thing, though, is Trump is still significantly better than a Kamala Harris administration. Even if you're just looking at federalism and Trump saying, I'll leave it up to the states, that gives you latitude on the state level to work. Whereas for Kamala Harris, she is going to do everything she possibly can through executive order. And well, Biden's already has done some of this, and also through the legislative process to ensure that they can codify on a national level Roe v. Wade. That alone is a big difference between the two on the life issue. There are other differences too. You may see Mexico City policy and things like that come back under Trump. Pastor Edwin Ramirez. Hey, Pastor Edwin. Edwin Ramirez spoke at our men's retreat, by the way. My Jets lost since you had that Aaron Rodgers handlebar mustache. I say keep it off, John. Sorry, Edwin. Sorry, I didn't mean to make the Jets lose. Rocket Man also put James 4:17, whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. Well, absolutely, yeah. If you know it's the right thing to vote and you've refused to do it, that's a no-brainer. Of course, that's sin. Even more important than voting is praying for America, praying that God will give us rulers who will allow us to live peaceful lives and proclaim the gospel. Agreed. Yeah, both of those things. We're commanded directly to pray for those in earthly authority under us so that we can live peaceful and quiet lives. And that's actually a very good thing, to live a peaceful and quiet life. I want that for my children. Sadly, I don't know that they're going to get that, but that is what I aim for. And that's part of the reason that you get involved in political things. That's why I do this podcast in part. So with that, hope that was helpful. More coming, Lord willing, later this week. Have a good afternoon. Bye now.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.